Good evening, everyone. This is a strange event of talking to a computer screen, but I know I'm talking to all of you separately. I want to acknowledge that from the beginning this remains a difficult time for everyone. Everyone is still experiencing a very altered lifestyle in terms of their ability to move around in the world and especially to see people and be with friends and family. So we have to acknowledge, I think that this is a very difficult time, and there's a great deal of suffering, not necessarily within the group I'm speaking to now. I hope not. I hope you're finding ways to cope. But certainly, as a society, as a country, we are going through a very, very difficult time. And I think that what's important to remember is that we're not going through this alone. And even if, we live alone or only live with a small group, I think it's part of our practice to understand that our life is going on. We always have companions. We always have a companion, whether we are by ourselves or whether we are not. And I think through our practice, we can actually realize this feeling and reality of companionship, of accompaniment on the way, And so, I think in your sitting, this is something that you can actually consider not just how you're supported by all beings, as we usually say, but actually that we're sitting to get, we are companioned in the way, every step of the way. And this is, of course, part of our, this is the kind of faith we have. So let's cultivate that faith. I think it's an important time to cultivate that kind of faith, that we are companioned on the way, that we are sitting together with Buddha and all beings. So what I've been thinking about just recently I think it's come up partly because of our class that we have on Tuesdays, we're studying the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so it came up to I'd like to speak about a little bit about the circumstances, and I was reminded of the circumstances in which that teaching was brought forth, that first teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha. And you may know this story, that prior to his enlightenment, Shakyamuni Buddha was practicing with eight ascetics, and they were doing lots of practices to deny the body, to mortify the body, and a hope of freeing their spirits from, earthly entanglement, entanglement with the earth element. And as a result of these practices, Shakyamuni Buddha came to the point of almost dying. And he realized that he was going to pass away without realizing what he set out to realize. And so he decided to leave, to isolate himself, to go off from his companions and seek some nourishment and try to get back in enough help so he could continue his path. And that's what he did, and he succeeded in getting some nourishment and proceeded to sit under the Bodhi tree and encounter unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And after that, he thought, oh, I don't know how I can possibly communicate what I've seen, what I've understood to my fellow companions. And he received a sign from the gods, or an endorsement from the gods, that indeed there were people who could hear what he had and could understand what he had realized, and that he should go and seek them out. So he had, at that point, due to his enlightenment, he had omniscience, and so he saw the location of his now five ascetic companions who were in Benares, in a place called Deer Park. And so he went there to see them. And when they saw him coming, they had a kind of reaction, because they thought that he had gone soft. He had left their version of practice and sought nourishment, sought food, and they thought he had, you know, gone soft, and so they weren't going to welcome him back into their circle. And they said to one another, you know, when he comes, don't greet him, don't give him any respect, don't make a seat for him. If he wants to sit down, okay. If he doesn't, that's fine. He can remain standing. So that was their attitude. And as he proceeded to come closer, they saw something in his bearing, in his demeanor, in his attitude, in the way he carried himself, and they were overtaken by that vision of enlightenment that they saw, that was manifest in Shakyamuni Buddha. And so without you know, despite their vow not to greet him, one of them got up and took his robe and bowl. Another began preparing a seat for him, and the third ran away and got some water to wash, so he could wash his feet. So in spite of their kind of shunning attitude, they made the Buddha welcome, and Shakyamuni Buddha proceeded to give them the teaching of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And this was the first turning of the Dharma wheel that we're studying now on Tuesdays. We're looking at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path of right view, right intention, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And this is the teaching that the four ascetics received, and according to the story, several of them were more or less instantly enlightened upon receiving it, and a little while later all of them became the first disciples. They became the first Buddhist Sangha, and the first disciples of Buddha. So we've been doing a lot of study of the path recently in Valley Streams and Sangha, because now we're studying the Eightfold Path, which is one description of the path. And previously, just in our last study of a book by Rev Anderson, we were studying the six paramitas, which is another description of the path that comes later. So there are many ways to describe you know, the Buddhist path. I was particularly struck, though, by this when it kind of arose for me to look back at this story again of the way the five ascetics who became the first five disciples, how they at first you know, they were like a high school clique. Like, oh, he's not good enough for us, you know, we're the cool kids, right? And so that was their shunning attitude that they had at first. But they were quickly converted. This is like in the early part of the Buddhist project, people were converted really quickly. Now, you know, later it became just, you know, the description changed later. Then as farther we got from Shakyamuni Buddha, the longer it took to become a realized person. And then it began to be talked about in terms of, you know, eons and, you know, a very rare occurrence and something that wasn't going to, you know, happen so easily. But at first it was very, enlightenment came very quickly. But what I liked about that story on thinking about it again was, the aspect of how the disciple who made a seat for Buddha. I think I don't know what the word is, but I'd like us to focus on that aspect of making a seat for Buddha. And I'd like to suggest that's kind of the project here. That's what we're really, doing, with our sitting meditation project. We are, of course, you know, we are, if we're just starting out, you know, we're working on, just, you know, we're just working on settling down, you know. We're working on settling down. We're working on just being with all the arising and passing away that's happening in our bodies and minds. And that's quite enough of a project right there. And maybe if we're, you know, starting out on the path, that's a good project to stay with for quite a long time. Just staying with, being with the arising and ceasing, just being able to be in your seat, just being able to take your seat and be in the seat and, just staying there. Just staying in the seat for the time that you set aside for your sitting meditation and encountering what you encounter. And that's quite wonderful practice and a practice that we might do for many years. And we might consider that we're, as I was saying at the beginning, we're not doing this project alone. That there is a principle of enlightenment in this world. It's the Dharma wheel has been turned, okay? And our understanding is once the Dharma wheel is turned in this world, it's always turning. It's always turning. And since that's so, we can participate in that turning in our practice. And we may be able to entertain the attitude or the faith, the trust that our practice is itself that turning, is itself that turning of the Dharma wheel. That when we make a seat for ourselves, we are making a seat for, we are making a seat for Buddha, and we are making a seat for our friends, our family. We're making a seat for our enemies too. This is the project really, is just to include every aspect of you, every emotion, every kind of thought. Don't push anything away. Just include all that's coming up in this body and mind. And then that will naturally and wonderfully extend to others, to include others. And I think that this idea of making a seat for our, for our sitting practice and for the welfare and benefit of everyone is crucial. It's crucial for the pandemic. It's crucial for the welfare of our society. When I was working, and it's been a long time now, I've been retired from working for over 10 years. But when I was working, I had a golden opportunity at the end of my working career to work on housing for the homeless. And I was so blessed because at that time it was a certain confluence of political will and funding and so forth, and we were able to do some really important projects and build housing for a number of homeless people, some big projects. And as part of working on that, one time I went down to see what they were doing in San Francisco to work on homeless issues. And I went to see, once a month they had an event or a social services event where it was a kind of a pop-up social services event where the homeless could come in and receive all sorts of services once a month in this big hall. And, so I went to observe what they were doing there. And one of the stations that they had there was a local Christian church. Came with its congregation, and they set up a station to wash the feet of the homeless people who came to the event. So this was their, this is in their tradition. This washing the feet is, of course, something that the disciples did for Jesus. And we have that story too. We have that story of one of the five disciples running off to get water to wash the feet of Buddha. So here's a Christian church, expanding who they're including in their love, in their hearts, in their vision of who's included, washing the feet of the homeless people who came to the service event. I really think that the progress of our society, of our world, is measured by how much and who we can include. So, I don't want to get too much into that, but I'm saying also for our sitting practice, it's also, I don't think I want to say measured. I don't want to say that because that's not what we like to say. We don't like to say we're measuring our sitting practice. We're not holding up a yardstick, you know, to our sitting practice and saying, how much have we improved today? That's not the point. But how much, you know, but you may naturally see in your practice, your ability to include more and to be relaxed with more that's coming up and to be more, you know, we're going to be talking, I think this week we're going to be in our class, we're going to be talking about right speech, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe we're not getting to that yet. But in any case, you know, how do we talk to people? What kind of language do we use? What's the attitude? What's the tone in our words, you know? Yeah, we can include so much in our understanding of how to treat people. I can't help but, I guess, veer off into societal issues. There was a wonderful decision by the Supreme Court in recent weeks. What they decided was that despite this, you know, they have a conservative liberal split. Everybody knows that about the Supreme Court. But despite that, in a 6-3 decision, they decided that the law that pertains to discrimination in on the basis of sex applied to gay and lesbian people and to transgender people. That law just said you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. And so now in the United States, you know, you can't fire somebody or decline to hire somebody because of what their sexual identity is. And this is this principle of expanding who we can include. Okay? So it's a principle that I support. I support that principle outside in, you know, the greater society, and I support that principle for Zen practice. I support that principle for sitting down and practicing and including not, you know, not finding fault with what comes up. You know, it's hard to do that. It's hard not to beat ourselves up. It took me a long time, and of course I still can fall into it, but I think I'm much better now than I used to be because I have, you know, 40 years of sitting meditation under my belt, and I've been looking at what my mind throws up for a long time. And I don't believe some of the things, you know, things that come up. There's some things that I just don't believe my thoughts about. So I want to leave you with just this idea of including Buddha at your meditation seat. Make a seat for Shakyamuni. Make a seat for Bodhidharma. Make a seat for Dogen, make a seat for your fellow practitioners. Make a seat, and when you do, make that big seat. I think you'll find that it's a very peaceful seat, even though there seems to be a crowd. It's not really a crowd, you know? It's not a crowd. Shakyamuni Buddha is a big principle, like Buddha is a big principle, but he doesn't make a crowd. So a friend of mine wrote a poem, that I got recently, and I'd like to read you this poem. I think this might be the end of my talk, but we'll see. This poem is called When I Get to Japan. Oh, and there's a temple mentioned in this poem. The temple is Rengyo Inn. And Karen and I were lucky to get to go to this temple in Kyoto. So you'll hear about this temple in this poem. When I get to Japan. When I get to Japan, I want to go to a temple in Kyoto called Rengyo Inn. Inside are 1,000 statues of Avalokiteshvara. Saving all beings, you can't tell me how to do it. And I can't tell you. And yet, I hear your teaching and you hear mine. Excuse me, is this seat taken? So Doralee said we could have some discussion. If we want to have some discussion, we can have some discussion now.
Yes, so everyone can unmute themselves, and so my suggestion is that you raise your hand, just like this, but I'll...
Doralee, somehow you muted yourself just then.
I did. So raise your hand, and then when I call on you, you can unmute yourself, but I will also be watching the participant list in case the only way you can communicate is to raise your hand there, if that makes sense. Carolyn.
Your poem reminded me of a trip that we went to Hawaii, and we just happened to pick up a local newspaper and discovered that this was the weekend that this particular temple, help me out here, was open. But it was so different because the way they had done this was they had carved into the mountain all of these, what would you call them?
Little temples.
Little temples. And you walk from one temple to another. You know, people had left little offerings in each one. And it was a wonderful meditation of just moving from one temple to another. I think there were probably 50 of them carved into the wall of this mountain. And it felt like it was a miracle that we found ourselves there. We were truly blessed to be there. Mm-hmm. I mean, this temple was not open very often. And it just happened that we were there when this opening occurred. So thank you for letting me share that. Yeah.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Kenny had his hand raised at one point. I don't know if he's decided he's...
It's chickening out.
No.
You said we're never alone, like even if we're angry or depressed or, I don't know, happy. Who is this person who's with us all the time?
Well, I can't, of course, tell you... who, to be with, I think what I'm trying to say is, you can invite Shakyamuni to be with you. And, as I think really Shakyamuni is the most companionable person or a principle, that you can, invite into to be with you in moments of difficulty. And, you know, what is that funny thing they say? What would Jesus do? Well, it's not quite like that, you know. What would Shakyamuni do? I don't think it's like that, really. But it is, you know, to the extent that we live in faith and trust in, you know, the Buddha principle and the principle of awakening, in the possibility, you know, even if awakening doesn't feel like it's here right now, we still may say, well, some people say it's here right now. It's always here. So maybe I'll entertain that, and see if it helps. And, you know, maybe Shakyamuni will arrive, or maybe not. But, you know, it's more has to do with your making the invitation. Peter has his hand up, I see.
Peter, we welcome
you. Yes, thank you. I am, first of all, I want to say that I was missing last week because I was on a 5-night backpacking trip in the Inyo National Forest, about 45 miles south of Mammoth, and I'm very glad to be back in civilization. My point I want to make is that it seems that we are often encouraged to shine light on things, to make things clearer, to elucidate things. And I do see a similarity of making a seat for something as to shine a light on it, to make it evident and understandable, as opposed to closing the door on it and putting it in darkness and hiding it and denying it. Last night, I just saw the 2019 Tom Hanks and Matthew Reese film in which Tom portrays Fred Rogers, the gentleman who did the Mr. Rogers show, I think that's what it's called. My mother used to take me out of school daily to go see that, show. And in the show, it's a feature film. It's not the documentary that came out a year earlier, but Fred has all these puppets that many of you are probably familiar with the puppets from the Land of Make-Believe, that I propose are very much different aspects of our own selves. You know, I could certainly say I'm just Peter Hewitt, I'm just one person, but there are many aspects of me such that I could say I have an aggressive, angry character, a puppet for that, and I might have a timid little, you know, as Mr. Roger has Daniel, I have, you know, a certain way that likes to be shy and more cautious. And I do want to make people aware of this gentleman, this Fred Rogers character, who unfortunately did die in February of 2003, the same day my son was born. And I think the puppets are a very good, I'm lacking the word, but a metaphor for our different selves that we do want to shine a light on.
Well, the great thing about that film was that I did see that film as well, and the great thing, you know, it's based on a true story of this journalist coming to interview Fred Rogers, and he's trying to, you know, keep his journalistic distance, and Fred Rogers senses his something's going on with him that's making him angry and closed down. And Fred Rogers just keeps welcoming him to open up. And of course he won't. He's trying to keep the journalistic remove, but eventually he succumbs to Fred Rogers' incredible charm, and it changes his life, you know. So this is a great story to bring up, you know, because this is this idea, you know, of welcoming, welcoming everything that's coming, and, you know, if it's, and also this kind of, you know, I mean, Fred Rogers really, I don't know what incarnation he was, but, you know, he had to be related to the principle of compassion. I mean, he definitely had that kind of avatar-like compassion. There's no doubt about that. Incredible. If you haven't seen those films, either the documentary or the feature film, I recommend both of them. It's very, very inspiring. Good medicine for the pandemic.
Will would like to speak.
I wanted to thank you, Jim, for your heartfelt talk. I really appreciated that. And when you were talking about having 40 years of meditation under your belt and watching what thoughts, you know, what your mind throws up. And I was thinking recently, as Gandhi and Martin Luther King taught the 9 nonviolent resistance. And when I'm sitting, I'm realizing that's what I'm actually doing, is I'm practicing nonviolent resistance to my own thoughts, even when I'm not sitting. I think that's where it starts. And that's what came to mind when you were talking about that. So,
well, thank you for that, Will. That's, you know, I was worried I was leaning too much on social issues, but I did have in my notes also the example of Rosa Parks. You know, she you know, the seat wasn't offered, you know, to Rosa Parks. You know, the white people in her community unjustly withheld the seat, but she took it anyway. You know, sometimes the seat isn't offered, and but you know, you're bringing up, you know, Martin Luther King, just makes me think, you know, of that example as well. Even if the seat isn't offered, sometimes the right thing to do is to take it, and then you can help people who are too have too narrow a vision. Again, this is the idea of inclusiveness inclusion. And, you know, Rosa Parks and, of course, her whole movement, you know, helped the white people in her community realize the narrowness of their vision and eventually, you know, give it up. But she didn't do it by being passive. You know, she took action. This is kind of what's, you know, happening now in our culture. People aren't content to wait for someone to give them the seat, you know, and rightly so.
I was jotting down the Eightfold Path that you noted, and I missed what the second one was.
The second? Oh, well, I say it as right intention, but Thich Nhat Hanh says right thought. Right thought.
I don't see a hand at the moment. Much to sit with, Jim.
I have a tiny little footnote to what Jim just said, that the lawyer who defended Rosa, he passed away. He was, I believe, 98 and still working.
Mm-hmm. I saw Linda raise her hand.
Linda.
I have clicked on the participants list, so now I can't see anybody. Okay. I appreciated so much the suggestion that we invite Buddha to sit with us. And it made me think of my favorite chant in our chant book is the Ehe Kosu Hatsugaman, because there's so many lines in it about how we are supported. And I'll just read this one little bit. Quietly explore the farthest reaches of these causes and conditions, as this practice is the exact transmission of the verified Buddha. Confessing and repenting in this way, one never fails to receive profound help from all the Buddhas and ancestors. And when I hear that and when I chant that, I can feel it. And anyway, I don't know how many of you have the chant book. It's on page 29. It's just, it's heartwarming to read it and chant it, I think.
Well, you know, I think, you know, just before, not too long before we we had to leave the Dharma Center. We couldn't practice there anymore. Not too long ago, I think in this year, I can't remember exactly. It wasn't more than a few months ago anyway. I passed out this this vision of there's the 12-fold chain of causation, and then I also brought to your attention this other vision of the path, which is like a 12-fold chain of the path. And one of the stages on that path, actually advanced stage of that path, is called the path of vision. The path of vision. And so this doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't mean, like, you know, having visions. It doesn't mean like working with images or something like that in your meditation. But it does mean holding some, vision, in the sense of the vision of the Buddha principle. And I think that chant, the Ehe Kosu Hotsuganman, it has that kind of visionary quality to it, that makes it inspiring. Because it says things like, even though our, you know, past evil karma has greatly accumulated, indeed being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way, all Buddhas and ancestors, basically come to our aid, they're constantly coming to our aid. And so this is actually, you know, the flavor of my talk. This is the kind of Ehe Kosu Hotsuganman talk, you could say, in a way. Because, you know, this vision we have a lot of past, you know, ancient karma. We're realizing even more, as white people these days, those of us who are white are realizing even more, you know, how past and evil our karma is. And yet, you know, we can't be stopped by that. We can't be mired down by that. You know, we have to continue. We have to create the positive vision to go forward. And I think this path of sitting meditation can really help us do that. And we can hold this positive vision of inclusiveness, of expansion, of letting all beings in.
Oscar would like to speak.
I'm reminded that earlier today I was having a discussion with somebody, and I guess it involved a mythic vision of how we function in the world, and a different dimension of what we're doing. A dimension in which everything is working together. Not explicitly a Buddhist vision, but a mythic vision. And in that discussion, I was reminded of how entranced I was when I first learned in school about biogeochemical cycles, how every atom in our body, is cycling through the ecosphere, sometimes in manners of days, sometimes in taking millions of years. So for instance, the blood the iron in the blood in my veins might have come out of the earth, the center of the earth, many, many millions of years ago, maybe billions of years ago, and has been through innumerable life forms and mineral compounds in that time, in the earth, in living matter, and it will be released and continue its journey, and at some point will be captured again in the earth's mantle, and maybe carried by subduction down back to the core of the earth. Every atom in our body is like that: oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, magnesium, calcium, all of the rest. And that's the way it actually is. Everything is just exchanging matter and flowing through time and space. When people are on a certain wavelength about things like that, like tonight maybe, there's a special kind of communication and feeling about it. I'm grateful to have that experience this morning, and I'm grateful for your talk tonight, Jim, which seems related. Thank you very much.
Well, maybe that's enough for tonight. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for supporting Valley Streams through this pandemic, and I'll see some of you on Saturday I'll see some of you throughout the week, actually, in various settings on Zoom.